Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 534. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on this network, please go and visit evergreenpodcasts.com. First, I'd like to give out a shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review for this show on Apple Podcasts by AC3Snow. Much appreciated. So this week's interview is with Ross Dawson. Ross is globally recognized as a leading futurist, keynote speaker, strategy advisor, best-selling author, and entrepreneur. He is founding chairman of the Advanced Human Technologies Group of Companies and founder of Bondi Innovation. Ross's previous books include the acclaimed book Living Networks, which the New York Times credits with predicting the social networking revolution, as well as the bestseller Developing Knowledge-Based Client Relationships. His latest book is Thriving on Overload, The 5 Powers for Success in a World of Exponential Information. We discuss with Ross the challenge of dealing with so much information, converting information into knowledge, encouraging stimulating strategic conversations at work, splicing through the signal-to-noise ratio, fact-checking, and how to thrive as a generalist versus a subject matter expert. You'll find all the show notes on minterdial.com. And if you have a wee moment, go over and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Ross Dawson, tremendous to have you on my show from down under. In your own words, Ross, how'd you like to describe yourself? Who is Ross Dawson?
Well, we have labels for ourselves, and the labels which I usually attach to myself are futurist, keynote speaker, entrepreneur, and author, which is quite a few, but those are the sort of the descriptors, I suppose, of what I do.
I somehow feel that they go together because, you know, one helps the other, right?
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's around thinking and communicating. You know, I'm a professional communicator in the broader sense, with words mainly, though some visuals. And in order to have a job communicating, you've got to think things which are a little bit different from other people. So I suppose my job is thinking a bit differently and communicating, hopefully, with impact.
So the bulk of what I wanted to talk about you today was, Ross, having met you and heard you when you came to London, was to talk about your new book, Thriving on Overload, The 5 Powers for Success in a World of Exponential Information. Let's start with, I mean, obviously you've written many books, but why this book? What's the context within which you decided to write this book?
So there's two answers to that question. One is that in the mid-90s, when I left corporate world and started doing my own thing, that was the first thing that I landed on in a way. So knowledge management was a emerging topic at the time. I said, wow, what a great idea. It's, you know, knowledge is something which we need to manage and think about. But what it struck me is that everyone was focusing on organizations, and really the big gap was on how individuals can make sense of a world of unlimited information. So I just come out of financial services. So I've been in financial markets and capital markets, and where there's a lot of information, and hopefully, you know, people are trying to make better decisions. And part of my role is helping to provide information in ways that were useful to make better decisions. And the education isn't there. The companies weren't teaching people, universities weren't teaching people, schools aren't teaching people. And so those that are good at being able to take on information and make sense of it, really worked it out for themselves. And so that was something I've been passionate about through my life, as I describe myself as an infophile, a lover of information, and, you know, being able to create value with it. And so, and as a futurist, that is in a way precisely the job. You have to scan through all of the changes in the world and try to make sense of those in a way that hopefully you can anticipate things and communicate that effectively. So this is a long journey where, you know, I wrote down the phrase thriving on information overload back in 1997 or something. And I built some frameworks which are actually quite similar to what I've developed. So it's just something I've believed in for a long time as something really important.
It strikes me that there's a parallel cousin to this problem, which is the overload of communications. Obviously, you can get, you know, your RSS feeds and the things that you're being sent, but the issue is also that we are overloaded with communications. We get, you know, Skype messages, ping messages, this and that, everywhere coming in. And I see a lot of people overloaded with that as well. What's your take on that?
Well, back, you know, again, from back at the 90s, the way I put it is that we have additional communication channels that don't replace but add to the communication channels we've had. So while letters probably you don't have a whole lot of, but we still get things in the post. And we have got documents, we've got emails, we've got, you know, the new social medias. So there's now we've got our Slacks and we've got our WhatsApps. So these are additional channels. So this is absolutely part of the overload is this channel overload, not just even how much information is within each. And essentially, we do need to be making choices. And one of the things, for example, in an organizational context or in an individual context, is to be very clear in communicating to other people what channels you want to be communicated to on. And that's because if you just say, okay, you can access me through all of these different channels, that starts to mean you've got to check all of these channels and you can simply cut some of them off or try to redirect them or just so say, okay, these are the ones I will spend time on. But this is very important, is communicating to others clearly. This is how I want to be communicated to because that works for me.
Well, I mean, I suppose the challenge is the other way around. I mean, if you're trying to reach somebody, for example, that you want to prospect or something, well, on what channels do they communicate? And you have to adapt yourself to them.
Absolutely. And that's so there is this issue of touching people or reaching people. And as a prospect, I think is one thing, or another is just, you know, value, you know, collaboration, right? Ways to be able to reach people. And I mean, it's interesting to me is that the emails are becoming more and more closely guarded. And so, you know, venture capitalists will never give out their email. And they'll offer various other guises where you can sort of be in their Twitter stream or whatever. And those people are overloaded, are saying, okay, well, email is where I only share that with people I want to be contacted with. And, you know, and also they're also potentially unhappy when people share their emails around that. And so they might, you know, be open to being touched in other ways. So it's also, you don't want to necessarily barge into people's channels. You know, there is this, as you say, there is this two-way thing of saying, well, what channels might they see, or what channels might they feel are ones they want to be respected and not be done? And I think there's a lot of people who get offended when people send them blind emails when you know, they haven't been given permission to contact them, whereas they might be open to sort of other channels, to having something where they can reach out if they feel like doing that.
I have the same kind of vibe in my mind with regard to people on LinkedIn, for example, for wanting to connect with me, connection requests. Hey, mentor, I'd like to be part of your network. Yeah, I mean, you being an influencer in this domain, how do you react to that?
So there was actually a long time. So I was one of the first 10,000 people in the world on LinkedIn. I was just, you know, exploring social networks, and I got on, and for a long time, I actually did very little with it. And in fact, when I was approached by people I didn't know, I responded saying, "Why do you want to connect?" But you know, that becomes that becomes too time consuming. So basically, I do filter through, and I just get a sense of, are they trying to sell me something, or is this somebody I want to be connected with? And so, you know, just filter out that way. And it's, and actually I've there's some similarity now to LinkedIn today for me with Twitter in the early days, where I met an extraordinary number of incredible people on Twitter in the early days of Twitter. That was, it was an amazing way of connecting. And LinkedIn actually is offering some really interesting new connections to me, which but they come across in different ways. But, you know, I want to be open to these interesting people who are engaging with what I'm doing or reaching out. It's not something you want to turn down.
At the same time, there are many interesting people in the world. And back to the subject of your book, it's like, well, if I got in touch with every interesting person in the world, well, I'd have no time for my wife, my family, because there's an endless amount of interesting people out there, presumably, especially if you have an open mind.
Yes. And so this is, you know, the wonderful thing of, you know, openness. You know, we need to be open to experience. We need to be open to ideas. We need to be open to perspective. But if we're at a certain point, that we inevitably get to overwhelm and to overload. And this is this delicate balance where we absolutely don't want to be too closed, because then, you know, we've got blinders on. We're not seeing what's going on.
We're going to become old grumpy men.
Or women. But so this is part of the, you know, it's never balance. I think, you know, this idea of balance is impossible.
Illusory.
You know, but you need to be somewhere where you are, you know, generally not too far one way or the other, and where you have an openness, but without, you know, where you have your boundaries as well. And I think it's easy for us to navigate. I don't think you can have hard and fast rules. You know, you can have some guidelines and parameters. If someone reaches out to me, this is what I will say yes or no to as a starting point. But I think there's just a general feel. All right, yes, this is somebody I feel like having a conversation with. And there's not a lot of people, but someone say, yeah, I'd be very interested to have a conversation and get some new ideas and so on.
Well, I suppose the like you say, it takes work to plow through a profile. They just click the button, connection request, no note added. I think there's a bunch of a laziness in there. And the other thing I think is interesting to find this, not balance, but to, let's say, put parameters that allow us to navigate through, is to understand your intention and ambition as well. And I think it's basically one of the fundamental messages of your book, is know what you're up to, know yourself better, and then you're going to be better able to navigate strategically through the overload.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, the first of the five powers in the five chapters is purpose, which, you know, as I point out, is a very difficult thing. And I think there's very few people can say, this is my purpose. I know my purpose in life. And hopefully we have some kind of a vague idea, at least, you know, and we're continuing to work on that. So this does require introspection. It does require knowing ourselves. It does require being able to explore and to discover, well, this is something, yes, I am even more passionate about than I might have thought, or I discover these amazing things, or no, this is not directions I want to go. So we need to explore to discover ourselves. And this is, you know, this reinforcing cycle of exploration as a way of discovering yourself, to know what it is you want to find and to spend your time with. And that's in a way, you know, the nature of life.
It certainly is. When you're young, you know, you don't know stuff. So you've got to go out there and try stuff and throw the spaghetti on the wall, see what sticks. One of the things you talk about, and something I certainly I've lived myself, is the notion of having multiple expertises or multiple areas of passion interest, as opposed to being a T-shaped, where you have one specific zone of deep knowledge. You talk about having multiple layers. I refer to it as being the comb version, where you have lots of teeth.
Yes.
In the comb. Tell us about that. And how do you, when do you stop the teething, so to speak?
So being a generalist is a very tough gig. And so I think to become a generalist, you have to start by having at least one area of specialization. You need, if you're shallow everywhere, that's not a generalist.
Doesn't sound like a great compliment. You're shallow everywhere.
So it takes time in a way to say, okay, here's one stake in the ground. I'm going to delve deep. And this is another one, which is complementary to that, where I can dig deep. And so I've had the time over fairly, you know, long career now to dig in quite deep into a number of different domains. And, you know, now as over time, the links between those become more and more evident, when that's part of my, you know, role as the futurist, is because I have gone deep into quite a few fairly fundamental aspects of, you know, the world and how it works, to be able to piece that together. So I think everyone aspires to be the generalist. And I think there's an incredible value to being the generalist. You know, and as you say, the T-shape means you, you know, you have some kind of context, at least whatever your depth is. But I think we do need to be quite clear around saying, this is an area where I will dive deep, and, you know, force yourself to dive deep by, for example, taking, you know, some formal or informal studies. You know, and so, you know, there are times when I've said, well, I think I know about this, but actually, let me do a, you know, go to a university course. And in fact, you know, you kind of say, well, actually, no, I didn't know quite as much about it as I thought I did, because you've been forced to actually dive deep. And I think sometimes people that feel themselves to be specialists, at times, not always, are sort of don't necessarily have as deep a grounding as they could or they should.
Yeah, it speaks to two things for me. That one is curiosity, the curiosity to want to continue to learn, to believe that you never will know everything. And the more you know something, the more you know you don't know something. And then there's the humility to allow for the impregnation of what you're hearing, as opposed to buffering it off and say, well, I already knew that, or of course. But sometimes it takes a little bit more grinding out to go down to the understanding, the bigger whys, the bigger ways that things are moving.
Absolutely. And I think that that's to truly be the specialist, to truly have the depth, you have to keep on digging. And that's there's a quote I just read from one of the great scientists of the last century, but is essentially saying you have to know an immense amount before you realize how much you don't know. And right. that's
yeah, the more so you know, the more you know you don't know. That's the same yes. underlying thought. All right, let's talk about knowledge. Obviously, you know, so in French we break it down in different ways, with connaissance and savoir, the how to do and sort of understanding of things. Your definition of knowledge struck me as very interesting and different than what I expected. And the context, I think, for this question is that I see a lot of people without knowledge talking about things, talking about it from a position of feelings rather than knowledge and facts. So your definition of knowledge in the book, you write, knowledge is the capacity to act effectively. And I was the part that was interesting for me was this, to act effectively as opposed to, well, the capacity. And you don't even mention really the idea of knowledge, information underneath it, the conversion of information into knowledge. So unpack that for us.
So that definition actually comes from my first book in 2000, Developing Knowledge-Based Client Relationships. And where, you know, there's lots of discussions around the classic data, information, knowledge, wisdom stack, and what's the distinction between knowledge and information data. And for me, knowledge is understanding of a domain, which means, and I think that ability to act is fundamental. It's making decisions. When you make a decision, you have a context and you are belief that that action will result, more likely to result in something you do want than something you don't want. And those people that are able to make better decisions are the ones definitely, you know, have knowledge of the domain. They have the understanding of the context and the references and the this gestalt of understanding that domain in order to make the decision to act in ways which lead to what it is that they want. And one of the key points for me is that knowledge is implicitly a semantic network. It is a connection in our brains of ideas and concepts. And in every brain, it is unique how we are connecting all of these ideas and the thoughts. And the formation of knowledge is basically taking in information and experiences and forming our own model from those of how everything fits together, how these reference points or data points actually make sense in understanding a domain, so you can know that if this action happens, that is most likely to result in that outcome, and with some degree of validity, as opposed to just being based on feelings, as you suggest. You know, I feel that I might want to do that. And if that is based on that intuition, which is essentially, you know, the subconscious representation of previous experience, that can be effective. But that feeling sometimes can be, not in fact that bringing together of experience, but more an emotional response, for example.
So the rigorous person in me, wherever he or she lies, as I look down for it, is wondering about the role of intuition in knowledge. How do you gauge your intuition to the extent that it's some unknown quantity within you based on the experiences that you've had? Unknown in the sense it's hard to put your finger on it. It's something that's a little bit amorphous, a little bit abstract.
Well, essentially in the quality of your decisions. So, of course, the seminal work on intuition was done by Herbert Simon, won the Nobel Prize for psychology. Oh, no, economics, actually. And so he's, looked extensively at decision making, and a lot of his work, very famous work was with chess grandmasters and their ability to, essentially use the gestalt of their experience, everything which they had, all the previous games they had played, in order to be able to know what the best move was. And so speed chess. So when a chess grandmaster plays against 30 different people at the same time, there isn't the ability to rationally decide what the best move is. You see the board and you feel what the right move is. And if you can win against 30, competent people, then that demonstrates that your intuition is good. There's not a rational thought in terms of thinking through all the possible moves. You are intuiting from all of your experience over time what the best move is. That's the only way you can play at that pace. So the analog is just saying, all right, we have an executive in a complex decision-making situation. And the way to judge their intuition, is their gut feel good, can only be based on the effectiveness of their decisions.
Welcome, change agents, to your go-to place for stories that ignite your spirit, fuel your purpose, and connect us all. We believe in the incredible power of the human spirit, its boundless resilience, and the inspiration it brings to our lives. On the Driving Change podcast, we'll journey together through the extraordinary yet very relatable experiences of some of the most amazing people on earth. Our mission? That through these stories, we might just spark change within you and awaken a newfound motivation to harness your unique gifts to make a real difference in the world. So get ready to be inspired and join us on this incredible adventure. You can find the Driving Change podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you love listening to your favorite podcasts.
Well, it's funny, when you use the word board, my mind slipped into board of directors as opposed to a chessboard. I was thinking about the parallels there. So you talk about a forceful prediction that's designed to stimulate strategic conversation, because in the end of the day, let's say we're acting as a board and we are wanting to be strategic. You talk about these ideas of strategic conversations. And from my experience, it was all too frequently not brought to the table, these ideas, strategic conversations. What's in your way of seeing how managers should be bringing more of these types of conversations into the big meetings?
You may be familiar with the book Scenarios by Cees van der Heijden.
I am not, but I'll note it.
It's an old book now. It's actually, I think it dates from the 90s, but it's still a wonderful book, which is it's hard. It's about strategic conversation. You know, and whilst the title of the book is Scenarios, it is about how it is we elicit strategic conversations. And one of them is to pose hypotheses and to uncover the implicit mental models. There's also some wonderful work done by Colin Eden and colleagues, who was at the University of Strathclyde before he retired. And what they were doing was using cognitive maps to elicit the mental models of the people in executive teams in order to be able to align them. So that's really central to my interests, is I suppose this, you know, there are different structures and mechanisms to how we can do that. So if we have a group, be it a board of directors or an executive team or some other relatively compact team, for actually get them individually and collectively to make their thinking, make their mental models explicit, which helps them to clarify their own thinking and also to uncover where it is that there are differences in those underlying mental models, and ones where which you enable to then have a truly valuable strategic conversation. Because my, you know, experience is that in many boards and executive teams, you have people talking at each other from different implicit mental models, which essentially means that you get an impasse. You don't, you know, you don't get a integration of those mental models, which then can create something which enables a better decision than either of the individuals working together. And so these are the kinds of conversations you need to have to really have a true strategic conversation, saying, why do you think that? What is the underlying things? And to pull down into what are the assumptions? Why do you think that this leads to that? And I think that eliciting these mental models is in fact extraordinarily valuable to any individual, because the way we think is not visible to ourselves usually, and this starts to then elucidate our own ways of thinking in ways that we can then align our thinking in between groups in effective ways.
Yeah, this speaks to me. Obviously, I'm writing a new book about conversation, and I talk about the you, me, us principle, where you have your mental model, I have mine, and the key is to understand what is it about us that we're trying to mutually go towards. And I think that one of the biggest challenges in so many cases is that there's no well-defined us. And this can be broken down into the issues of politics at the home or with friends. And it can be also applied to nations. It can be applied to companies. So you're sitting across from the director of some other department, and you get into some kind of quibble or discord, but there's nothing that unites us at a meta level to show that we both need to get through this and listen to one another and then collaborate towards something bigger. I suppose, how do you react to that?
I suppose one of the frames around that is simply purpose, is aligning purpose, aligning values. So these are more common exercises within executive teams, and they are absolutely fundamental. You know, why are we doing why are we doing anything at all? You know, why does this organization exist? And that starting point of aligning around purpose and values is a fundamental starting point. And I think, you know, fortunately, most organizations are sort of reasonably articulated that. I mean, whether that articulation is close to the reality is a different question, but at least there are articulations of that. And so that is the starting point where you can then start start to align your mental models and of the industry, of your organization, of how it's can be successful in the future.
Well, you have optimistic viewpoint about how companies describe their purpose. I find it wholly lacking in most of the conversations and businesses I get to work with. When you talk about having conversations in the boardroom, there is inevitably a question of knowledge and how much each one knows about the industry and what's coming out. You also have intellectual property and knowledge that should be confidential. So how do you parse through that when in this issue of overload?
From an organizational context? Or?
Well, yeah, as an individual, you're running a company maybe, and you have knowledge. What knowledge? I mean, some companies are extremely guarded on the knowledge that they have, which makes it very thick and difficult to get through all the information layers because it's parsed out. They specifically only want this team to know about this part of it, and this other team is supposed to know only about this. So they're sort of compartmentalizing the knowledge, and it becomes very complicated to understand or make it fluid one through the other and to accept external opinions or external information. I think of the tech companies in particular, of course.
Yes. Well, I mean, pulling back to the big picture, there is really two ways to frame an organization: information open by default or information closed by default. So information closed by default, saying the only reason, you know, the only way we will make this accessible is that you need to know it. Otherwise, it's not available. As opposed to saying the only reason we will not make this available is that there is, you know, a legal reason or a, you know, a competitive reason or whatever. And so, you know, Atlassian is one of a number of companies which has the open by default policy, as in everything in the organization can be seen by anybody, unless, you know, there's, for example, a securities filing, which, you know, can't be released before an investor, you know, investor event, for example, in which case that's shut down. And as you might suspect, my sympathies are very much with the open by default in terms of being able to create value. So that creates more information, creates more access to information, but that allows, amongst other things, alignment on values, alignment on purpose, alignment on mental models, and in particular, for an organizational context to be able to take in information which is relevant to decision making and to feed that into decisions. And so, you know, again, some older reference points, but Carl Weick wrote around organizational sense making. And I think that there is an incredibly strong analog. An individual brain, you know, an individual mind, what we do is we make sense of the world. We have information coming in. We make sense of that. We form a mental model and we make decisions. There's a very, very strong analog to an organization, which is immersed with information. Information comes into the organization. It makes sense of it in some implicit form. It makes decisions and acts as a result. Now, of course, so what we are trying to do essentially is to make an organization an effective analog of an intelligent brain, a well-performing brain, where if information signals come in externally, as in, oh, this competitor is doing something new, which we hadn't even imagined, or this new technology could impact our distribution or whatever it may be. So the organization as a whole, every person in the organization is part of that sense-making apparatus and can then bring that into, essentially, the locus of decisions, be that the board, executive team, or broader group of people, so that is making effective decisions based on the fullest possible information. And that is simply not possible if you live in a closed by default organization.
We're living in a world which has all this information. We're also living in a world that's very divided. And so in a personal side, you can quickly close off yourself, talk about closed environment, to read the news that you want, because it satisfies what your sense making of the world is. And we've narrowed it seems to me sometimes our scope in how much we want to make sense of. And so if you're in a business, you can also very quickly have the same challenge of, you know, this is what we're doing. This is the only thing that we need to be figuring out. And it can quickly lead to blind spots when you create that sense making, if you get it wrong somehow, or if you're not able to adjust.
Yes. And so this is where, we need to be flexible and adaptable in a fast changing world. And as part of the, my tagline for a lot of my work these days is in an accelerating world. So the world's moving faster and faster. So clearly staying the same in an increasingly fast moving world is not going to work. So whether the unit be the individual or the team or the board or the organization or the nation or the city or whatever it may be, this need to be able to be flexible, to adapt, to sense what are the meaningful changes and what are the useful responses to those is at the heart of being able to have any kind of success, however one defines success.
The thriving component. I definitely get the feeling that for most of us, at least at our age, Ross, somehow we got bundled into this without really proper training, whether it was the overflow of communications or the overflow of information. And so we're always having to play catch up. Oh, there's a new Telegram. Oh, there's a new RSS feed. Oh, there's a new Slack. And I think the vast majority of people, and certainly the statistics seem to show out, there is an incredible amount of burnout, and people are suffering, not thriving, in this overload. So what words of wisdom would you provide for them?
I mean, in a way, this does come back to something which is very simple, arguably trite, which is we have to let go. It is impossible to keep up. Accept it. And it's, a lot easier said than done, because, we're always trying to say, well, I'm feeling behind. I don't know if I'm on top of things. I want to be able to know what's happening, but we have to acknowledge we are limited. Even if we were to be away, all of our waking hours dedicated to the relevant information, never stopping except to have necessary sustenance, we still wouldn't be able to do it. So we just have to be gracefully accept that there is only so much we can do and to draw that line. And so that is there is emotional courage in a way to be able to do that. We cannot get to the thriving from a point of just feeling we need to keep up. And so I frame this as from thriving to abundance. And this is the frame of saying, well, rather than saying, okay, there's far too much that I could ever possibly keep on top of, I will always be behind, to saying, I have all of the information I could possibly want to achieve what I want, far more than ever before. So whatever it is I want to do, that information is available to me as never before. So it does require this mindset shift. And as it is a lot easier said than done, but at the same time, there's actually nothing else we can do. Unless we change our attitude, we are going to inevitably be massively overwhelmed and overloaded.
Well, so I wanted to cite a friend, John Perkis, who wrote The Power of Letting Go, if anyone wants to pursue that thought further down. And it brings up a topic you started talking about at the beginning of the book, which is the paradoxes. Dealing with our paradoxes, and you cite the work done by Professor Myron Spector at INSEAD about the paradoxical mindset. What for you, Ross, is the biggest paradox that you face?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is what I've described to myself as the paradox between Zen and creating the future. And so in the world of Zen, the only thing that exists is the present. There is nothing else. The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. There is only now. And we must live now. Otherwise, we don't live at all. Mm. So that is a paradox when we say, well, I want to work in order to be able to create something better for myself or my family or the world or whatever. And that's a future which might never happen, which is just in my imagination. And right now, the omnipresent now, I am working hard to something which doesn't exist. And that's been, you know, something I've grappled with for all my life. So I lived in a Zen dojo in Japan for a year and studied under a Zen master there. And that's, you know, I suppose, you know, I don't think I can well articulate it, but I think I have gained a better appreciation of it. So when you go in a Zen monastery, work is meditation. So if you're in a monastery, or if you go on a Zen session, a sort of a focused meditation session, you sit in meditation, you know, for extended periods. And then you sweep up in the kitchen, sweep up in the open areas, you chop things for the kitchen, you clean up. And all of that work, all of the things you are doing are just as much meditation as the sitting. That's your meditation is in the work. Your being in the now is in your work. And that's something, again, which is, you know, easier to say than to truly appreciate. But I mean, that I suppose that's been my journey, is to try to resolve that deep paradox, because society is all based around progress, working till tomorrow, building our fortune, whatever.
And efficiencies, effectiveness.
Yeah. And it takes most people away from the ever-present now.
And so I'm dying to ask, Ross, what was the trigger that made you sign up for this Zen experience in Japan?
I first read Alan Watts' books, The Art of Zen and The Way of Tao, in my late teens, I suppose. And that sparked, you know, and I've read many, many, many Zen books in the subsequent years and thinking about that. And long story, I just ended up in Japan. And
at what age? At what age?
I was 29. When I landed in Japan. And that's a long story in its own right. But I quickly found, yeah, and that was one of the reasons I ended up in Japan as opposed to someone else. Somewhere else was because of my interest. I found this Zen master who taught classes in English on Saturdays and studied on him. And then he had this Zen center where English speaking people could live together in a Zen community. So I went to work as a financial journalist, and came back and did my community chores, and we all meditated at least twice a day and listened to lectures. So it was being part of that community for a year.
Well, I'm sure it contributed to help, or it helped you to understand a little bit better who you were.
Yes, it's there is no substitute for meditation. Meditation takes myriad forms, but our default mode network, our brain's always active, it's always on, and any way to be able to quiet that is the only way to really find a little bit more who you are. Otherwise, there's this constant chatter.
Yeah, in the paradox that you refer to, being futurist and the living in the now, there's also the past. That, I mean, if you don't know your history, then things will repeat. And like you've cited so many giants of the past, we're always living on the shoulders of giants somehow, even as much as we want to think we're original and smart and all this. So that even complicates worse, is that you've got to understand all the past somehow as well, or not, in this idea of sense-making.
Yes, and it's, you know, again, we can never, you know, read all the books we want to read of all of the millions of amazing books that have been, but we have that abundance. We have that available to us, you know, the incredible literature, incredible ideas and thinking from, you know, from now backwards. We can, you know, use this as the foundations. And as you say, we're always building on what we have. That's the nature of humanity. That's the nature of progress. We have been able to capture our ideas and the best thinking and discover that and to use that So that's these are the resources we have. And that's part of the reason why most people should be spending more time on the long form content that has established demonstrated value, as opposed to most people who spend the majority of their time on ephemera, which tomorrow will be forgotten.
Yeah, like TikTok or some unverified sources. I think it's an important topic, this notion of verification of the source, the validation of your sources. And reading a book that's been self-published sometimes can bring up the questionableness of the validity of what's being in there in terms of indexing and verification of sources and the footnotes and whatnot. So what it brings up, if you will, ChatGPT, which, you know, it does so many marvelous things, and it looks like it's citing verified sources, and it looks like everything is appropriate, but it's not. And so what sort of shortcuts can you provide in establishing the validity of sources? It doesn't seem like there's an easy path, and just telling ChatGPT, give me verified sources, doesn't seem to be enough either.
No. So at this point, there's only two solutions. One is manual checking. And the other is there's some people who are creating some apps at the moment, which are, for example, if a link is given by a large language model, it will just go and check that link is actually valid, as opposed to imagined. And, potentially to have some kind of other checks on that. So there is a very simple layer of automation which can assist in being able to assess the what's produced hallucinations. But I've found times when the majority of what I get back is hallucinated, but it's still valuable. For example, I've asked in the past for books on a particular topic, and it gives me a couple of books I've read, a couple of books I haven't read, and a book that doesn't exist. And for the books I haven't read, the ones, oh, okay, actually that is interesting. And so you got to do your homework and legwork and so on. Or again, I was actually researching non-white male definitions of intelligence. And so there's immense amounts of hallucinations generated in the responses, but it pointed me towards some people. And it had invented quotes of those people, but I found those people, and then I found things they actually had said, which were relevant. And so it doesn't, cut time to nothing to give you the answers, but it's still more efficient if used in the right way and for the right purposes. So you just need to, not expect it to give perfect answers, but simply to be a tool which can be deeply questioned. The classic description of treat ChatGPT as an intern, as in it's smart, it wants to help, but it's probably going to make some mistakes. So you got to check everything, but it can still be helpful.
That's a very good way of presenting ChatGPT 4.0. Last question for you before we close out, Ross. What are the tools that can help us in this idea of parsing through? What are the top tools? And can AI actually easily help us today in curating the information that we need?
The broad answer is I've been disappointed forever and still today, really, in the quality of information filtering tools, including AI-enabled ones. So what I would point to is the promise of them becoming a lot better soon. So I still largely use manual filtering. I use RSS feeds. I go particular sources. And obviously, if you are using social media in any sense, there are algorithms behind that, which with varying degrees of quality. But if you train, you can train social media algorithms by only demonstrating any hint of any interest if it actually truly is something you want to see more of.
Be aware of every click you make.
Yes, exactly. And you know, some and the algorithms can be start to be more useful and effective for you. And so there's still an array of tools. There's some interesting initiatives I'm seeing, but I won't mention them because they're not really good enough, I think, to talk about. But I think they are promising in terms of the potential of AI to fill more effectively. And it's, you know, it's kind of astounding to me how poor our information filters are still today, which, you know, puts the onus back on us. We've got to keep on looking for the tools and use what's good for us. And, you know, it hopefully, you know, avoids us falling into the trap of relying on the machine too much.
We need to take accountability and responsibility for the issues. As the Stoics say, it's not what happens to you, it's how you react to what happens to you that counts. So, Ross Dawson, a futurist, what lies in the future of Ross, and how can we connect with you and that future?
So I got a number of new initiatives coming out. So, I mean, my general work is at rossdawson.com. So I've recently rebranded my podcast, which was titled Thriving on Overload, to Amplifying Cognition. And that's to bring together these ideas of thriving on overload, as we've discussed, and humans plus AI, which is my major theme at the moment. So amplifying cognition points to a number of the other initiatives which I have at the moment, which includes a new humans plus AI learning community, and also a new AI app, Thoughtweaver, which provides an interface to make more effective people's interactions with GPT and other large language models. So all of those various resources can be accessed at amplifyingcognition.com.
Brilliant. The use of the word weaver makes me think of a little bit the old-fashioned notion of the hands and the sort of the artisanal and back to the reality, which is that it just can't be some simple, easy thing. We still need to be manual. We still need to bring the human with the AI. And it's been a pleasure listening to you, Ross. I appreciated very much your perspectives. I enjoyed the book. I think it's a desperately necessary book, Thriving on Overload, because I think of the problem of the lack of thriving in people's lives. And I think of the predicament of this overload of communications and information as one of the things that has hijacked so many of our lives that we're not good at it. So many thanks, Ross, for being on the show. I look forward to staying in touch and encourage everybody to go get your book, Thriving on Overload. Thank you very much, Ross.
Great pleasure, Minta.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minta Dialogue podcast. If you like the show and would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MintaDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 and more blog posts on MintaDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
A stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hopeful you respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die suburb. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man. Competition's innate, a convinced man. In the arms of a woman, despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready, fire and arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts, and now available on YouTube.